Good morning, and welcome to the Wednesday, March 24th, 2021 meeting of the Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached to the calendar event that you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Ms. Sunderland, would you please take the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsten.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski. Representative Drazkowski. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Representative Jordan, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from Thursday, March 18th? And if so, would you like to move approval of those minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I reviewed the minutes, and I moved the minutes from March 18th.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Jordan motion? Hearing none. All those in favor of approval of the minutes from Thursday, March 18th, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Jordan. Members, today in committee we'll be hearing a handful of bills, and we don't have time to waste, so let's get right to it. The order of the bills is reflected on the agenda you received last night. We'll be taking up House File 709 first, then followed by House File 1169, House File 681, and then ending this morning's session with House File 1144. That we're hoping to devote much of the last half of the meeting to. It is our intention to cover these bills this morning and then recess at 11:55. We'll be laying all of these bills over for possible inclusion. Representative Jean, would you like to make a motion to move House File 709 before the committee to lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Yes, Chair, I'd like to move it for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Representative Zhang. Members and members of the public, all testifiers and authors today have been notified of time limits that they're expected to stay within in order to respectfully move through the bills that we have before us. So with that, Representative Sandell, welcome back. We miss you.
Looking I miss you, Chair Dabney. I miss you and the members and all the conversation about education. And I certainly agree with you that there's no time to waste words at this point in the session. But when it comes to recognizing great accomplishments and remarkable promise, it's easy to be effusive. I learned about the Minnesota Council on Economic Education early in my teaching career, and I've been a big fan ever since. The work of its director, former Representative Dr. Julie Bunn, is a model for other councils around the country. Its influence, its teaching, professional workshops, and curriculum development can be recognized in elementary school classrooms as well as in post-bac and graduate seminars around the state. Few of us question the role of economics in our personal lives, our professional decisions, or understanding of local or international affairs. I believe that economics should have a prominent place in our school curriculum, The problem is that fewer than 2% of our social studies teachers have an academic background in the subject, and many elementary teachers never took a course in economics while in college. House File 709 would provide an appropriation of $250,000 in each year of this biennium to help MCEE continue to deliver an ambitious professional development program and increase the number of teachers it reaches through its affiliated centers of economic education at 6 colleges and universities around the state. During the past year, the entire portfolio of the program moved online, and I thought that was a prodigious accomplishment. MCEE is uniquely qualified to offer this opportunity for professional development. There's no other organization routinely providing these benefits for Minnesota teachers. It's a pleasure for me to have Dr. Bunn and Ms. Brandy Sinequi with me today to prove all that I've said is absolutely true. Mr. Chair, I'd like to begin with Ms. Sinequi.
Thank you very much, Representative Sandell. Ms. Sinequi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is Brandy Siddiqui. I'm a teacher at Edison High School in Northeast Minneapolis, and I appreciate this opportunity to share my story. As a high school social studies teacher, one of the least desired classes to teach is economics. Economics is not like history or geography or government. It's different, it's more technical, and there's not a clear timeline. And the concepts, they feel a little bit void of human contact and interaction, so they're a little bit boring and dry. Typically, no one wants to teach economics because no one really feels comfortable teaching it. It's not where their passion lies. We go into this profession for history, not econ. As a result, social studies departments, we often struggle to find teachers who are willing and want to teach economics and who are good at teaching economics. In a week-long MCE professional development course I took way back in 2015, I learned how to gamify teaching economics in a way that I could not have previously imagined. In the course, I learned to use scenarios, games, and stimulations to increase student comprehension. And because I was more comfortable with the content, I was able to perform these tasks with students. MCE's course, How to Teach High School Economics, was the best training I've ever had, being given a focus on economics. Most districts don't really have training or professional development on economics. And while there are many other sources for other subjects, economics simply does not have as much. The sources we have are often loaded with terminology, and it's confusing, and it's really boring and dry. MCE was the first training that really changed my mind about teaching economics. It was clear for the first time, and I felt like I really had a tangible resource to use. I had seen things. I had played games. Most secondary social studies teachers have only taken one, maybe two college-level classes in economics. As teachers, we really need more support. MCE is unlike any other resource in the field in terms of training, and they provide that for our teachers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Siddiqui, very much. I'm sorry of the boring and dry part of economics.
You can make it fun. It's so much fun.
Outstanding. Dr. Bunn, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Dabney and members. She left out dismal out of that list. My name is Julie Bunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. MCE targets its teacher professional development efforts to approximately 1,600 newly licensed teachers each year and to a pool of over 25,000 in-service teachers who, based on their license, may be, over the course of their career, required to teach economics and personal finance. Demand for our workshops increased during the pandemic. In fiscal 2020, the number of teachers reached doubled relative to each of the previous 2 years. And in the first half of 2021, we reached the entire number of last year again. So it continues to increase. MCE is one of the preeminent state councils in the country. In addition to curating the best curriculum and lessons from around the country, MCE writes and supports its own top quality curriculums. It's the only council developing curriculum and training teachers in global food markets, sustainability in the environment, and entrepreneurship. And is unique among all state councils in offering workshops and culture responsive and inclusive methods of teaching economics and personal finance. MCE also delivers on its mission by engaging students directly through competitions and by reaching communities through adult literacy programs. Several of our programs are targeted specifically to underserved populations. MCE is asking for only a small portion of the direct cost to deliver this programming via K-12 based funding. MCE used to receive significant financial support from federal grants and from in-kind staff support from institutions of higher education. These funding sources are gone, and grants from private sector sources are not sufficient to train all our state's teachers. At the minimal necessary staffing level, MCE is running deficits to sustain its programming at this time, made possible by drawing on finite, dwindling financial reserves. At a time when the future of financial literacy education and the need for it is greater than ever, and when multiple pieces of legislation to strengthen the personal finance requirement are moving in the legislature, and when the House Select Committee on Racial Justice stressed the importance of financial literacy education, this funding will underwrite the council's efforts to sustain and increase its programming. In closing, more testimonials from teachers and students are contained in your packets for this hearing, and in video links and emails you received in previous correspondence. I encourage you to take some inspiration from them, as hopefully you did from our teacher, Ms. Siddiqui.
Thank you, Dr. Bunn.
Thank you for your consideration.
Questions from members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Representative Sandell. I noticed that Representative Katizo-Attun has also introduced a bill that's gone to Commerce. So are you working with her, or are you going to resolve who's going to take responsibility for this? Just comment on that, because I noticed that that's also similar to yours, but it's in the Commerce Committee.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erickson. Certainly, Dr. Bunn can give you more details on this, but I have been working with Dr. Bunn and with Representative Katizo-Attun. The money we're asking comes from two different sources, and I think Dr. Bunn can maybe be more detailed and succinct than I can. Dr. Bunn?
Dr. Bunn?
We had a ask in 2019 for $500,000 in the base through K-12. We received one quarter of that part temporary for 2 years. Our need is reflected in both these bills. They're not substitutes for one another. They're a joint ask, spreading the request across two lines, commerce and education. So the two combined represent the ask and our need from the legislature. And the two combined is less than we asked for in 2019. We know the many demands the legislature has on it. So we are asking for $250 in the base in K-12, and we found a special fund within Commerce to carry some of the burden of supporting these efforts in the next couple of years. That's why there's two bills. They do not duplicate each other.
Thank you, Dr. Bunn. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Sandell, for bringing this bill forward. I do have a couple little questions. I noticed on 2.18, if there's any extra money left after the first year, it does not go back into the general fund. It just stays in with this bill, basically, to go into the second year. And normally, at least the bills I've read in the past couple of years, normally that money would transfer back to the general fund. Is there a reason why that's not happening?
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Daniels. I guess the reason is that we'd hope that the appropriation might be considered a two-year appropriation. And sometimes it's difficult to anticipate what might be possible as far as professional development workshops and classes. But Dr. Bunn, having being an alumnus of the legislature, could probably comment on that a little bit better than I can.
Well, let's let the chair step in here. Representative Daniels, good bill reading skills. It's that's not an unusual provision in bills, and will certainly be part of the conversation going forward. But many organizations ask for that flexibility. Do you have another question? And members, we are wanting, as I indicated at the beginning, to move along today. Another question, Representative Daniels?
Just a quick question. I tried to go through about a dozen bills last night, and I thought in this one there was a number of teachers that dollar amount would reach to help for training and such. I didn't see it in the bill now. Could you refresh my memory of how many, with the ask, how many teachers that'll actually help?
Dr. Bunn, is that best for you or Representative Sandell?
I could take that, Chair Dabney. Our aim is to reach up to 2,000 teachers a year. It varies from year to year based on the length of each workshop and the types of workshops. We are currently, this last year and the first half of this year, reaching some of the highest numbers we ever have, but our goal is to try to reach 2,000 teachers a year. That's in direct teacher professional development of some kind. In addition to that, many other thousands more access our website and download lessons and resources from our website, whether they're taking a class from us that year or not.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Bunn. Moving on to Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to Ms. Siddiqui for all your work. Edison High School is just a few blocks away from my own home. It's in my district. And I know the entire Individuals and Societies department at Edison High School is, I'm always impressed by the amount of engagement that students have where they will call me up and ask me about my job, which is great to see from constituents. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what this training has done for your students. I know you, Brent, mentioned that in your intro, but I am always impressed by how engaged students at Edison are in social studies. So can you talk a little bit about how this training has manifested for student engagement? I'm really interested in some of these games, for example, that you mentioned.
Sure. Ms. Siddiqui, please.
Thank you for asking the question. So one thing is when you first try to teach econ, it's a textbook and there's lots of terms and it's kind of boring and it's fill in the blanks. And I didn't really understand how to make it something tangible and like really like appealing to students. And so one of the games was we did a game on price gouging where they had money, like fake money, obviously, and they had to go buy goods and resources. And so one side of the class had to go to one team and the other side of the class had to go to another store. And they got to buy things, but one side price gouged where the prices are like twice as high as they normally are. And then the other team kept it the same. So one side obviously ran out of everything and the other one didn't. And it was cool to have a conversation than like, what would you rather have? Toilet paper, like we all experienced last spring. Had we price gouged toilet paper, maybe more people would have it, but poor people wouldn't have it. And so it's like getting them to think critically about something that maybe didn't really make sense at first, you know, like price gouging by its fundamental definition seems kind of like, okay, but like playing a game where they're able to like really actually interact and do it changes their understanding because it feels different when you can't buy what you need versus just being like, yeah, that's cool. So I think that really changed it. There's another game we played where just supply and demand and then having them negotiate and haggle and things like that. And things that a lot of students of color, especially from different communities, really used to like price haggling, but like letting those abilities really shine, which is kind of fun. We played other games too, where they, had to do, this sounds silly too, stages of production, like what's most effective, what's most efficient, and then like trying to have them make a paper link chain game, which sounds silly, but like it really helps exemplify stages of production, what makes something increasing marginal returns or diminishing marginal returns are negative, and like how businesses increase labor first, but not tools and stuff. And so it's really fun. It sounds kind of cheesy, like out of context, but I promise you it's fun. I had a kid tell me they were going to play the stages of production game at their birthday party from Northeast Minneapolis.
Ms. Siddiqui, nothing dismal there at all. And it sounds like we could have used your price gouging experience on the House floor yesterday. Representative Sandell, any brief closing points?
Chair Dabney, thanks very much to the testifiers and to all of the representatives who asked questions as well. This is a terrific bill. It's a terrific organization. I met Dr. Bunn 3 or 4 years ago. I was impressed immediately with her super brilliance and her hard work. It shows, I think, around the state. So thank you, and I hope we can have your support.
Thank you, Representative Sandell, Ms. Siddiqui, Dr. Bunn, thank you for being here today. Note to members and the public, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of the bill. We received no requests from the public to testify. With that, Representative Zhang renews his motion to lay House File 709 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Thank you all. House File 1169, Representative Sandsteed, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1169 to be before the committee to lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Good morning. Yes, I would. I move House File 1169 to be before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much. Representative Drazkowski has joined us. Members, we're looking to complete our deliberation on this bill by 11 a.m. Representative Sandsteed, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. House File 1169 would extend a grant for an existing state pilot for the Rock and Reed project using untapped funding from the prior 2019 grant. Rock and Reed is an innovative program that helps develop student reading skills through music, technology, and fun. It uses singing to improve the reading ability of students in grades 2 through 5. Because of the pandemic, many schools that wanted to implement the software program during the school year were unable to do so. And as a music teacher, I know how valuable music instruction is for brain development. It helps activate neurons in more areas of the brain. And research has indicated music overlaps with reading, as many of the same children who can't keep a steady beat also struggle with reading. Singing and chanting poems over a steady beat may be the missing link for these struggling readers, which is vital for early language processing and the development of reading skills. Minnesota students have made dramatic gains in reading, both by using Tune Into Reading, otherwise known as TIR software, and by using the singing strategies teachers implemented with their whole class and existing curriculum. In 2017, one-third of fourth and fifth graders who scored at the bottom reading level on the MCAs, who increased their scores in 2018 after singing and reading songs with a software program for at least 13 and a half hours. The bill requires Rock and Read to select participating schools with priority to schools in which a high proportion of students are not reading proficiently at grade level and are eligible for free or reduced priced lunch. We know how big a struggle there has been over this past year for Minnesota learners, exacerbating already wide opportunity gaps. This funding will be critical to help struggling readers who are now even further behind due to the pandemic. I do have a testifier with me today, Anne Kay from the Rock and Read program, if I could turn it over to her.
Thank you very much, Representative Sandsteed. Ms. Kay, please state your name for the record and proceed with your brief testimony. Thank you.
I'm Anne Kay. I'm a co-founder of the Rock and Read project that was established as a nonprofit in 2014. Chair Davney and representatives, thank you for hearing this bill. Good morning, good afternoon, I'm so glad you're here. That's how we start every student on this singing-based software that we purchased and implemented in schools. And we have, under the state pilot, helped 2,500 students in 25 schools, both district and charter, in urban and greater Minnesota. And we're just here to ask for an extension. Yes, due to the pandemic, we were unable to use all the funding from our last bill in 2019. So we're just asking for an extension so that the schools that wanted to do it this year with large proportion of students not reading proficiently on MCAs and free and reduced lunch can do so starting in the fall again. So they're not penalized further. The data is clear. The MCA analysis affirms the existing 4 or 5 controlled research studies on this product. It's phenomenal. 1 year on average reading gain in 13 and a half hours. People always say 13 and a half hours. How could that be? But that's what it is. And so Representative Sandsteed referred to the brain research, which is accumulating. And without a doubt, music making enables the brain for reading. And it, and she said also, if a child cannot keep a steady beat, for example, they almost always struggle with reading. And even high school students, the more accurate they are at tapping to a steady beat, it correlates with higher reading achievement. Language and reading sound over time. So I just want to tell you a personal story. We have many personal stories besides the data. My favorite personal story, Savion, first year, fifth grader. The minute we started that song, he didn't want to sing. He was embarrassed about singing. How are you going to sing in front of my friends, you know, and he refused. So the co-founder, Bill Jones, took him out. You know, Bill's a strapping 6'6" guy, and he started singing with him in the hallway, Do Re Mi. Well, Savion started singing, and the two came back, and he agreed to sing with Bill at the computer. He became the number one fan of this software program. Unbeknownst to him, we did a reading pre-assessment. He was a fifth grader reading at a second grade level. He was 3 years behind, but he didn't know that. And so no stigma. The students are just reading songs and getting rewarded for singing better in tune and in rhythm over steady beat. And he just improved his singing dramatically. He was so excited by this program. He roared through the second grade songs. He went up to the next level, third grade songs. And by the time the program ended for him, he was reading songs with words and vocabulary and context at a fourth grade level. I just looked him up. He's at a Minneapolis public high school. He's a senior this year, on track to graduate in June. And I often wonder, where would he have been? So I thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kay. Representative Erickson, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, not a question, but I have experienced the Rock and Read project, visiting a charter school in St. Cloud, and did it myself, and then visited with the students, observed them, and I can tell you that this really helps so many students, and it's a great innovation to use to connect music and reading. I always knew that was true, but I got to see it firsthand. So thank you, Ms. Kay, for being here.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Seeing no other questions, I do again want to note that when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of the bill hearing. We received no requests. Representative Sandsteed, any brief closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, members, I just want to reinforce the power of music in reading and word acquisition. You don't really have to look any further than even like a movie like Aquila and the Bee, who used rhythm to help become a national spelling bee champion. And then also think about commercials on television and how so many of them use jingles to really reinforce what they're doing. And with that, members, I would just appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. With that, Representative Sandsteed renews her motion to lay House File 1169 over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Thank you, Ms. Kay, for testifying today.
Thank you.
Next, House File 681. Representative Jordan, would you like to make a motion to move House File 681 before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion or for further consideration at a later date?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House File 681 before the committee for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or later action.
Thank you very much, Representative Jordan. Members of the committee and members of the public were looking to lay this bill over by 11:15. Representative Frederick, welcome to the committee. Before you introduce your bill, I understand you have an author's amendment you would like to offer to get the bill in the shape you'd prefer. The chair will move the DE1 amendment to be before the committee to put the bill in the shape that the author desires. Representative Frederick, let's first have you speak to the amendment before we vote on it. Can you briefly describe it, please, sir?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So my original bill was pretty squarely targeted on the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota, which I think is awesome. But this amendment is much more inclusive of all of the different children's museums and education centers throughout the state. So it's a bit bigger than what I originally intended, but all the different museums are amazing, and I'm super excited to be able to have a bill that puts some more funding their way.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Members will adopt this amendment on a voice vote. So at this point, renew my motion that for the DE1 amendment. Any questions? Seeing none, if members would unmute, all those in favor of adopting the author's amendment, the DE1, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Representative Frederick, please introduce your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my bill, as amended, funds different museums and education centers throughout the state. I So specifically looking at the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota, which is obviously my district, it's close to my heart. I love that place. They've got a treehouse on the inside that I always want to kind of crawl up, but you know, I don't want to get in the way of other kids that are looking to climb around there. But it has, there's just education aspects and STEM aspects that these different museums really dive into in their own way to kind of serve the communities that they're in. This also includes the Minnesota Children's Museum up here in the city, is obviously the biggest one out of the bunch. And I think they're all just phenomenal and deserve as much funding as we can throw their way. And I guess at this point, I would turn it over to anyone from the museums.
I have on a list Louise Dickmeyer, the CEO of the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. Ms. Dickmeyer, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Louise Dickmeyer. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to address you here this morning. Just a few thoughts. The Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota serves 100,000 visitors annually. We've welcomed guests from all over the United States, from every state, as well as six other countries. And in 2019, our last full year of operation, our Minnesota visitors came from 75 of the 87 Minnesota counties. So we have a large draw. Access has always been a priority of the CMSM since it started in this location in 2015. And the mainstay of our access program is our Gateway to Play membership. This is a membership that is provided at no cost to any family facing barriers, whether it's economic, cultural, language, military service or special needs, for examples. No questions asked. In January of 2020, we had 2,300 total members, and of those, 668 were our Gateway to Play families. We strive to try to maintain at least a third of our members as Gateway to Play. And we partner with 50 community organizations and agencies to connect with families in need. And these include, for example, Head Start, Echo Food Shelf, the Minnesota Council of Churches, and the YWCA Refugee Service Programs, Mankato Area Public Schools Teenage Parent and Achievement Integration Programs, Partners for Affordable Housing, and Connections Ministry, homeless shelters, to name a few. Access initiatives here at the museum also include hosting school groups. Each year, we have subsidized 8,000 to 9,000 second and third grade visitors from increasingly diverse rural schools, many of which have a 50% or above free and reduced lunch rates. Our museum educators provide these kids with a STEM-based educational experience that meets the Minnesota academic standards. And I'd like to note that children's museums originated in the United States. There's 300 of them in the world and 280 exist here. I really hope that Minnesota continues to lead in promoting and supporting the impact of children's museums as we play an important role in early childhood development. We provide a safe place for children and families to play, which is needed now more than ever. And we are truly a source of happiness. Finally, I'd like to just close with sharing the perspective of one of our Gateway to Play members just this year, a mom. And she writes, "My son is autistic and my children are homeschooled. This membership gives us an opportunity to learn and build social skills and have quality time together. It also inspires creativity and curiosity. They get a feeling of I can do it when they make, build, or try new things. From the one-on-one guiding and mentoring on science and farming topics, to a 3D printer, to making butter and bread, and especially making apple juice on the press each fall, the kids love it all." So with that, I thank you for your time and your consideration very much.
Ms. Dickmeyer, thank you very much. Next on the agenda, Jill Mizels, CEO of the Works Museum. Ms. Mizels, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Hi, I am Jill Mizels, CEO of the Works Museum, located in Bloomington. Thank you, Chair Dabney and committee members, for having me this morning. I'm happy to be able to share a little bit with you this morning about the Works Museum. The Works was established in 1995, and our primary focus is STEM education for elementary age kids, so primarily kids ages 5 to 12 in the Twin Cities and throughout Greater Minnesota. Our mission is to inspire the next generation of innovators, engineers, and creative problem solvers. And we know that not all kids that we reach will pursue a STEM career, but we hear from employers that the benefits honed from the skills learned at the Works Museum, such as persistence, creative problem solving, collaboration, are skills that all children need to be successful in wherever their future path may take them. However, as Ms. Dickmeyer mentioned, we also experience kids that have challenges accessing the museum due to financial constraints, whether it's through their family or through their schools. So we have a similar program as the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota called Gateway. And Gateway is our access program. And I'm here today to share a little bit with you about Gateway. Gateway provides access to children and families that are on state or federal assistance through a variety of ways. On-site field trips at the museum and on-site engineering workshops, off-site engineering workshops and family events at schools and out in the community. And then since last spring, we were forced to develop a virtual slate of programming due to the pandemic. And now we have virtual engineering workshops for schools, for families, for camps, and even virtual birthday parties. And what this has really done has been enabled us to even expand our geographic reach to more families throughout Greater Minnesota, because now we can provide opportunities for them virtually as well. In 2019, we served about 80,000 children and families through our STEM program, of which 35% or 28,000 came through our Gateway program. COVID-19 has caused significant academic disruptions, and we know these disruptions to kids from lower income families and schools only will be precipitated by the STEM opportunity gap. So our Gateway program is more important than ever to provide access to these students because the learning experiences they have now are predictive of the type of experiences and successes they will have in the future. And it's not that low-income kids don't have interest in STEM. They have as much interest as kids from more economically strong backgrounds and higher income backgrounds. It's just access to these programs. And so what our Gateway program does is provide access to all children, even those children that may not have that opportunity to access them on their own. We also know that what is so important about a STEM education is that STEM occupations are projected to grow by almost 9% between 2014 and 2024 compared to other job growths within the state of Minnesota. And it is so important to engage young kids of all backgrounds in STEM because it is our STEM workforce that will help drive Minnesota's state of innovation and competitiveness. And as we've seen, scientists and other STEM professionals are on the front lines of fighting this COVID-19 pandemic, and we all know we need today's students to solve our future global issues. So I'm asking you today to support these museums in providing access for all children to be engaged in STEM programs that are so critically needed to push the innovation in our state today and in our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Musels. Members, there is a document in your packet. Ms. Adrians, can you review that for us, please?
Sorry for the delay there, Mr. Chair. Yes, the document shows the history of museum funding going back to 2016, I believe. And there are two chunks of funding. So there's funding that the legislature has appropriated through the Department of Education, and then there also has been some funding appropriated through the legacy funds. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out that for the legacy funds, those are appropriated on a one-time basis. So it's quite possible that they will receive funding for the fiscal years 22 and further out. But as of now, there have not been any amounts appropriated for those years. So you can see that the base currently for fiscal year 2022 for the Department of Education appropriation is a total of $460,000. And the way that that's broken out, the Minnesota Children's Museum receives $269,000. The Children's Museum in Rochester receives $50,000 per year. Duluth Children's Museum also receives $50,000. The Minnesota Academy of Science gets $41,000 a year, and then the STEM program at the Headwaters Science Center receives $50,000. And so I just wanted to point out that the amendment for this bill, it would add an extra $100,000 to this base, even though it looks like it's a number of different funding streams. It would add, pardon me, $50,000 for the Works Museum, and then $50,000 for the museum, the Children's Museum in Mankato.
Ms. Adrians, where is the Wheel and Cog Museum?
Mr. Chair, you're going beyond my expertise in Children's Museum. You might have to ask if anyone else has an answer to that question.
All right. It's Stump Nonpartisan Staff Day for those who celebrate. We'll put that as a research opportunity.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Hutchinson.
Hutchinson. Thank you very much. Well done. Representative Sandstead, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, this is actually for the author. I'm just curious, and maybe you mentioned this already, how were those particular museums selected for your bill? And the reason I ask is that the Grand Rapids Children's Museum has often come before this committee and has received appropriations and has done really some phenomenal work. If you could just tell me a little bit about that, that would be great.
So Representative Frederick, you should know, I don't believe the Grand Rapids Museum has engaged the committee this year, which might have been an oversight. Representative Frederick, anything else you wish to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as well, we just heard that there's already those the funding sources from the different museums in the past. And so the two that we're really adding is the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota and the Works Museum. This cycle, I know that I personally was the one who was pushing for the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota. I know it, speaking with the chair is how I learned about the Works Museum and wanting to get them added as well. Whether or not specific other museums within the state have not received funding, I can't speak to. I don't know the history of the different within the state. All I know is that the more that we can fund museums and create that cultural opportunities and those learning opportunities for people all across the state, I think is a good thing.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Representative Sandstead, anything else?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, when this bill was added to our schedule and posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify before. For the public portion of the bill hearing, we received no request from the public to testify. Representative Frederick, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I will just add, and I can't believe I forgot to bring it up when I did the opening remarks, was there is a line in the amendment, too, that says that this money needs to be focused on encouraging or increasing access to historically underserved communities into all of these museums. And so the point of this particular bill and this funding is to get more people access to these wonderful places. And so I just wanted to point that out too. And I thank members for any support they're willing to give it.
Representative Frederick, thank you for that and pointing that out. And obviously both Ms. Dickmeyer and Ms. Mizell spoke to their access program. So appreciate that. With that, Representative Jordan renews her motion to lay over House File 681 as amended for possible inclusion. Ms. Dickmeyer, Ms. Mizell, thank you for joining us today and testifying. Representative Frederick, thank you. Members, House File 1144, Representative Feist, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1144 to be before the committee and to lay it over for possible inclusion or for further consideration at a later date?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1144 be considered for being laid over in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee and members of the public, we're looking to lay this bill over by 11:55 a.m., at which point we will recess in anticipation of returning for our evening hearing at 6 p.m. I have to remind myself we're recessing so I don't accidentally adjourn the committee, but it's also a heads up to members. Representative Feist, before you introduce your bill, I understand you have an author's amendment you'd like to offer to get the bill into the shape you'd prefer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do, and I'm happy to explain it.
I move the A2 amendment to be before the committee to put the bill in the shape that the author desires. Now that it's before us, Representative Feist, please tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On further consideration, it might make more sense to just vote on the amendment to get it into the shape that I would like, and then I can kind of start from the beginning and explain the larger context for the amendment and what this larger bill is trying to do, if that's all right with you.
That's just fine. Why don't we also let you be the one making the amendment or making the motion to for your own author's amendment. So Representative Feist moves adoption of the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form that she prefers. Any questions to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Feist motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Feist, to your bill as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present House File 1144 to you this morning. The purpose of this bill is to improve compensatory revenue, one of the largest pieces of school funding formula, which is intended to enhance the achievement of students from low socioeconomic status. Compensatory revenue uses free and reduced lunch levels as a proxy to identify schools with the greatest need for this funding. Mr. Chair, so first I will explain the amendment. First, the amendment would allow students free or reduced price meal status to continue as long as the student remains enrolled at the site. A student's family would be required to report to the school if their income increased beyond the eligibility level. The second change would allow any school participating in the Federal Community Eligibility Provision, or CEP, to use the count for the school site from the fall prior to the school site joining CEP. This would ensure that schools that have made changes to obtain federal dollars and therefore are no longer reliant on state-level lunch funding aren't penalized for compensatory revenue purposes. The count would be authorized up to 4 years, but a new count is required each time the school site re-ups in the CEP. And lastly, the amendment adds the governor's language for compensatory revenue hold harmless aid and hold harmless aid for the tribal contract schools that was released in the supplemental budget. And Terry Yetter from MDE is on hand to speak specifically to that provision if there are questions. In addition to the changes made by adopting the amendment, House File 1144 would do three things. First, it removes the cap. Under current law, the concentration factor in compensatory revenue does not increase once the school's percentage of students on free and reduced price lunch hits 80%. The cap unfairly penalizes schools with more than 80% of their students qualifying for free and reduced lunch, free and reduced price lunch, many of which are high need. And schools affected by this cap can be found both in the metro and greater Minnesota. Removing the cap would benefit students across the state, ensuring that all students get the critical resources they need. Second, this bill requires compensatory revenue to be spent on evidence-based practices. Let's make sure that we are using the funds wisely on strategies that are proven to boost student achievement. This would be similar to the effort that Representative Bennett is working on and that we've heard in this committee. In the Office of the Legislative Auditor Report on Compensatory Revenue released this year, the OLA stated that, quote, little is known on how district spending corresponds with allowed uses. This recommendation is consistent with the OLA evaluation. And lastly, this bill requires 80% of compensatory revenue to be spent at the school site, which generates the aid. Because the districts currently only have to use 50% of the funds at the school site that generated the money, it is unclear how much of the funding is being directly spent on the students it is intended to benefit. Students generating the aid should be the focus of the aid. And the same recommendation can be found in Governor Walz's budget. Now more than ever, especially coming out of the global pandemic, we can address the staggering opportunity gap by making these changes. These changes ensure a more equitable distribution of compensatory revenue, that we're focusing resources on our most vulnerable students and using these critical resources effectively. I'll turn it over to my first testifier, Ms. Paula Cole from Educators for Excellence. And we have a number of other testifiers as well. And I look forward to answering questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to testifiers, Mr. Strom, I believe you've prepared three documents for the committee related to House File 1144 as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Yes, there are three documents, and we don't probably need to spend too much time on any of the three. The first of those will be the governor's recommendations that Ms. Yetter speaks to with the compensatory revenue, a whole harmless that the governor has proposed in the revised recommendations. This follows our usual district by district list and shows the revenue amount that each school district would receive under the adjustment. Essentially about $60 million is showing up on that printout. I'm happy to take time later to walk through that printout with members or perhaps at tonight's meeting when there's more time. If members have questions on that printout, we can discuss that further. The second and third printouts in the packet are two different ways of looking at the effect of removing the 80% cap. The first of those sums those amounts up to the district level, which is how this committee usually sees school finance information. So for those districts that have a school site over 80% free and reduced lunch eligible, there's additional revenue generated at the site level, and that's rolled up in that printout on the district by district list. The third printout shows the same thing, but at the site level. There are 2,300 school sites in Minnesota, which often leads to very long lists. So we rarely display information for the committee on the site basis. But on this printout, it selected those sites, all of the sites in the state that have a free and reduced lunch count over 80% of the enrollment at that school site. And it shows the increased revenue that would flow to each of those sites under House File 1144 as amended. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions about this or wait till this evening or talk with individual members, as I know time is precious.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Ms. Cole, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. My name is Paula Cole, and I'm very grateful, Chair Daphne, for this opportunity and also to Representative Feist for sponsoring this bill, and to the also thank you to the co-sponsors because this is a really big opportunity for us to do something with money that we already have allocated, right? It's always an opportunity. So I am the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota, and we are a teacher-led nonprofit with approximately 2,300 members across the state. Let me tell you why I'm here. Our teachers are teaching right now, but we have been in conversation about this for the past few years, and the organization itself has been working consistently along the lines of the following. We need, we support school funding that is equitable, that is going to result in positive academic outcomes, that is going to decrease the opportunity gaps and hold school leaders accountable, and also that is transparent down to the student level and accessible to all. We have learned from Representative Feist, that many of you already know from the OLA report, that compensatory aid funds are not targeting the students who most need them or who even generate the funds. These funds are being sent to districts. And before telling you the following, I want to offer a full disclaimer. I'm also a Richfield School Board member, but I'm not telling you that in that role. I'm wearing my E40 hat, and also Richfield is not even in the schools that will be targeted by this, but I want to bring an example because I always like to do that. We have in a small community four schools for elementary services, and one of them, Centennial Elementary, is the one with the highest poverty funding. So if I'm on this board and I were to receive, we were to receive money from the state as a district and not give it to Centennial, where I know is clearly highly, you know, more needed at that charity than at the west side of the neighborhood, then I can see, you know, that was really how I saw how this would be a problem, because as you all know, poverty has a say in the achievement gap before students even step school for the first time in kindergarten. And that is a lot of where the issues with reading and math come from. That's where more supports are needed for intervention, for reading resources, for other supports for students. And that's why I think it's really imperative that we are allocating the money directly to schools. And not only that, right now I find that there is a lot of wiggle room in how districts can allocate this money. So I'm really hoping that we can ensure these funds are used for things that are proven to work, especially for our communities. As always, please let us know if you want to talk directly to teachers about this. And we are happy to keep the conversation going. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Cole. Next on the agenda, Lucilla Davila from Falwell's Performing Arts Magnet in Minneapolis. Principal, good to see you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representative Vice. My name is Lucila Davila, and I'm the principal of a K-8 school here at Falwell Performing Arts Magnet in Minneapolis Public Schools. Today, I'm asking for your support with the HF 1144, which would improve our compensatory revenue here and funding. As a principal firsthand, I have, and as we speak, I just finished our budget for next year. And as you can see, there's a declining funding with the compensatory aid funds statewide. And with that declining funding, it's when you're doing budget, you have to then make cuts. And here, Falwell is a school that is pretty much 83 to 85% free and reduced. So therefore, we are a school that we get additional funding, but it's still not enough. And when I'm saying that it's not enough, when we are looking at, first of all, and first most, the compensatory education funds help support here at Falwell to lower classroom sizes. So we have a nice ratio between teacher and student. It also helps us with the individualized learning in small groups, catered to instruction or interventions and academic progress. We also use the money closely for kindergarten readiness, especially full-day kindergarten. Some schools don't have full-day kindergarten programs. We are lucky to have four classrooms full of full-day kindergarten, a full-day program. However, there are, that school readiness is vital, and there's a lot of components that come with that. That additional support that we need for the individualized learning, because we don't have a student that fits in a one-size-fits-all. And ComEd also helps with our parent involvement, and especially the academic pieces of really coming together and seeing how the students are learning to then put all the supports within the resources for a STEM program, reading program, especially the reading programs that I was hearing earlier and the STEM and STEAM programs that I was hearing earlier. Those are all vital programs that we use funding, that we use compensatory funding for our students. And with the declining funding, it has really put a strain on public schools and our school here at Falwell. So, in short, I'm here to urge you to support the HF1144 because it is a step in the right direction to providing more equitable education for all of us and our students. And I thank you all for today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Principal. Next on my agenda is a member of the Minnesota Youth Council from De La Salle High School. And frankly, the damage I would do to your name just isn't kind. So I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself for the record and proceed, and then I'll work on it. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Chair Daphne, Representative Vice, and other members of the committee. My name is Bolu Ilaboye, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Youth Council. I'm also a student at De La Salle High School in Minneapolis. 10 years ago, I moved from Oklahoma to Minnesota because of my parents' job. Initially, we were excited about Minnesota schools because they rank highly compared to others in the nation. And Minnesota is also known for its progressive funding formula that is designed to send more money to high-need schools. But what we didn't know was that Minnesota also has one of the biggest achievement gaps in the nation, and that the state's poverty aid to schools is in need of reform. A few years ago, I had the chance to join Congressman Keith Ellison's Youth Council. My project was about the achievement gap. I learned about inequitable resources, about implicit bias in education, and about the belief gap that stems from the achievement gap. Since that time, I've been involved in service such as volunteering at programs specifically for underrepresented minority students in order to address these inequities in education. I care deeply about House File 1144, but my eyes certainly may glance over the mention of the word formulas. To me, this bill isn't about formulas. It's about meaningful academic and social programming that will open doors for my friends, relatives, and community members in the future. Because while I'm lucky to have access to a school with resources, most students in Minnesota who look like me do not have the same experience. I'm asking you to support House File 1144, which will improve the compensatory funding. At first glance, you may be thinking, what does a student have to say about funding formulas? I care about this issue because I believe that budgets are a reflection of values. And it's clear to me that if Minnesota lawmakers care about ensuring that all students have the opportunities to learn and grow, they need to pass this bill that would ensure that students who need the most will receive the most. At the end of the day, we all know, or I hope we all know by now, equitable does not mean equal. If this funding is really going to be equitable and impact students like my relatives and friends, it must actually be spent on those it's intended to benefit and used to provide meaningful programming, teaching, and service that have a great real impact. I urge you to support House File 1144 because it is a step in the right direction towards doing this. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bice, and the members of the committee.
Mr. Iliboyu, thank you for your testimony. Much appreciated. Next, Matt Shaver with Ed Allies. Mr. Shaver.
Chair Dabney, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Matt Shaver, Policy Director at Ed Allies, a nonprofit whose mission to put underserved students first in policy brings me to testify in support of House File 1144 as amended. We thank Representative Feist for her leadership and vision on the issue. In general, the higher the concentration of kids in poverty, the greater the per pupil compensatory dollars those students generate. The formula works in a logical way for schools serving between 0% and 79% of students in poverty. At 80% and above, schools are penalized by the formula for serving too many students in poverty. The per pupil dollars freeze and are the same whether you are a school at 81% or 100%. Fortunately, there are only around 150 schools in the state that in a given year are at or above that 80% threshold. I taught at three of those 150 schools, and yes, some of them are in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but these district and charter schools that serve extraordinarily high concentrations of kids in poverty are spread throughout the state: St. Cloud, Rochester, Duluth, Bemidji, Red Lake, more. Those schools have been shortchanged by the compensatory revenue for a long time. Minnesota is the only state in the country with a compensatory-like revenue stream with a funding cap like this. HF 1144 removes that penalty and unlocks funding that should be going to schools sprinkled throughout our state with the absolute highest need. It's the moral minimum to lift this cap. There are other great items in this bill that will support just about every school in the state and address both immediate issues and longstanding challenges with compensatory revenue. Briefly, requiring 80% of the funds to stay at the site they were generated at should be seen as a technical fix, given that nearly every district surveyed by the OLA report last spring said that all of the funds were already staying at the school. Requiring the funds to be used for evidence-based practices is logical, self-explanatory, and much needed. The author's amendment alleviates the burden of schools tracking down families to fill out the same forms each year that are literally worth more than their weight in gold to schools and districts. This amendment allows a form to be valid as long as a student is enrolled at the school, something a school leader told me last night would be, quote, a godsend. This will make compensatory revenue more predictable for schools and districts while freeing up time to focus on serving kids. Which leads to the hold harmless amendment. According to DHS, only 36 out of the 336 districts in our state reported the same or greater free and reduced price meal counts from last year to this year. This is a real one-time challenge that districts are facing that underlines the desperate need to no longer rely as heavily on a high-stakes piece of paper. Finally, you'll hear more about the community eligibility provision in this committee tomorrow, but this federal program pays for schools with high concentrations of students in poverty to just feed all of their students. And much like how we don't ask kids how much their family makes before allowing them to use kickballs and school buses, makes meals just part of the offered school program. Minnesota has one of the lowest CEP participation rates in the country, and that is partially due to concerns about losing out on compensatory revenue. The fix included in this bill will no longer force schools to choose between feeding all of their kids and receiving a fair amount of academic revenue. In sum, this bill will help compensatory revenue live up to its purpose, allow funds to be generated and used more equitably to support low-income students and English learners. Thank you to Representative Feist and to the co-authors for your leadership. Thank you all for your public service.
Thank you, Mr. Shaver. Last on my list, Benjamin McKenzie, Hiawatha Academy's teacher. Mr. McKenzie, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Dabney. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Ben McKenzie. I'm a teacher at Hiawatha Academy. I'm also a member of Educators in Excellence, which represents over 2,300 teachers around the state.
Mr. McKenzie, can I stop you? The sound quality is quite poor.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that improved it. So well, why don't you give that a shot, and if it doesn't
sure.
Stay that way, turn off your video. But please, proceed.
Will do.
I apologize. It's a delicate balance right now. As I said, good morning, Chair Dabney. Good morning to the members of the committee. My name is Ben McKenzie. I'm a teacher at Hiawatha Academies in Minneapolis, and I'm a member of Educators for Excellence, which represents over 2,300 teachers throughout the state of Minnesota. And I want to start today by thanking Representative Feist and my co-testifiers for authoring and standing up in favor of this proposal, which would be a crucial step towards equitable education everywhere in Minnesota. While E4E engages on a wide range of education issues in Minnesota, I feel it's vital to appear today in order to advocate for the students I serve. I've spent my career in teaching because I want to support the brilliant young scholars I meet each year, and it's because of them that I feel compelled to testify today. At my school, the vast majority of students are living in poverty, and the reality is difficult enough, but our current school funding makes it only harder for them to get a quality education. And although the infrastructure is in place to adequately and equitably provide education to schools like mine, we have not been able to use those resources yet because we have not been able to ensure they are reaching the classroom. This bill would ensure that more funds are spent on students who are generating them. Lifting the cap on schools with high percentages of poverty like mine would ensure that children who benefit from the funding would get the boost. In addition to ensuring that students feel the boost, we need to take a hard look at whether we're using the money in ways that make current improvements to academic and social outcomes. With more equitable funding, I know that my school can deliver some of the most vital programs to boosting student outcomes. These additional resources could ensure hands-on science experiments, both in person and in distance, batches of books to connect readers to each other and build comprehension, and stronger parent supports to serve students both in classwork and in homework, which are some of the things we've seen be most effective and in need of most funding. Increasing educational spending is critical, but we also need to ensure that those funds are positively impacting students who need it most, students who live in poverty, my students, and those I know. I urge you to support House File 1144 because it's a step in the right direction to providing a more equitable education system. I want to thank you, Chair Dabney, and members of the committee for your time and hearing my testimony. I hope my students can count on your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McKenzie. Members, questions?
Mr. Chair, I believe we have a couple of additional testifiers.
Oh, I'm sorry, they were not on my list. Representative Feist, can you identify them, please?
Yes, oh. I know Mr. Kroonquist, Scott Kroonquist is here, as well as a former school board member from St. James.
And Representative Feist, you are right, and I am wrong. I just had to scroll a little further down my list. My apologies. Mr. Kroonquist?
Good morning.
You know the drill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And in the interest of saving the committee some time, I'm also testifying for the Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Appreciate the opportunity to share a few brief remarks about House File 1644 and want to thank Representative Feist for sponsoring this important legislation. First, I want to note that we are very grateful and supportive of the hold harmless language in the bill. I think many of you know and you've heard from your local school districts that absent this, our school districts were looking at really a major loss of revenue across the state. AMSD member districts were looking at an average reduction in compensatory revenue of about $900,000. In fact, with some districts would have seen reductions of $4 or even $5 million. We also appreciate Representative Feist looking at methods beyond applications for free or reduced price lunch to determine compensatory funding. This method has been a challenge even before the pandemic, and obviously with the data that I just shared, you can see how what a significant challenge it was during the pandemic trying to get those applications turned in. And then lastly, and I had a little chance to talk to Representative Feist about this, but we are still working on gathering information from our districts regarding the language that would require 80% of the revenue to be spent at the site. And we certainly agree that the funds need to be spent, and they are spent, on the students who are in need of those services. But just quickly, the reason there is it's important that there is some flexibility at the district level to make sure that happens is that it's not uncommon for a site to be a relatively low poverty school site and really generate little or no compensatory revenue, but still have students in need of services. An example might be that site might have a population of English language learners. And really, the compensatory revenue then is able to fill in behind and help make sure that that site could have an EL teacher, for example. So that's just one example of why some flexibility is important to make sure we actually do serve all the students who need those services. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman and members, but thank you again for the opportunity and for hearing this very important legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist. On my list, Luisa Trapiero, a former St. James School Board member. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fisk, and members of the community. My name is Luisa Trapero. I'm a community member, but also I'm a former board member of the St. James Public School, District 840. This AFHA 114 is so important to all the, not just the metro, but also the outer parts of the Minnesota, because we have seen a big change in our demographics. Also, I mean, by ensuring these funds we are being used to evidence the base way to impact the students who are behind, and they are thoughtful rotation behind how funds are being used and how to close the achievement gap. Also, you know, if I guess the most of it is just to support this bill. A lot of my other members have said it right in there. We need to have this support to be more equitable on education. And this is all what I urge you guys to do is support this HF 114, because it's a step to the right direction to provide a more equitable education throughout the whole state. I just want to say thank you to everyone, especially to Ms. Fisk and the committee to get this this bill in there. And I hope you guys do take it as what we need to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Trafiero, for joining us today. Members, unless Representative Feist needs to correct me again, I think it's time for questions. Representative Kreisha, you are the only one with your hand up.
Shocking. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, remind me of your timetable so I can respect that.
We're hoping to finish up by 11:55.
Very good.
That gives you 12 minutes.
Okay. I can do that. Just a couple, Representative Feist, thanks for bringing this up. Thanks for your bill. Congratulations on a hearing in front of the Ed Finance. Mr. Strom, if I could just ask you briefly, can you walk me through, I believe I understand it, but I just always like to have your affirmation. Could you walk me through two school districts which are similar? That would be Bemidji and Brainerd. And just walk me through exactly the difference in the compensatory change.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, members, perhaps if Ms. Burt puts up the spreadsheet at the district level of the 80% and above, that may be helpful. Let me start by saying that the compensatory revenue is calculated at the site basis. This means that the ratios are determined and the concentrations determined at each site. So a district's compensatory revenue is the sum of its site's revenue, not necessarily the sum of its district characteristics. Rather, each site gets added together. So with a situation between two districts like Brainerd and Bemidji, even if the two school districts had the same concentration at the district level, if their sites were different, if one had twice as many eligible students for free and reduced price lunch at one site and half as many as another, their compensatory revenue would be different because of the way that the revenue is calculated using concentration at the site. I'm not sure if this is exactly where you're trying to go with this or not, Representative Kreisha, but if you look at the printout that Ms. Burt has just put on the screen for us, you'll see that for the Bemidji School District, there's 4,969 pupils at the site using our measure called enrollment. 1,456 are free lunch students, 418 are reduced price students.
we take the free lunch students plus one half of the reduced price students for a total of 1,665 funding pupils, which gives them a concentration at the district level of 33.5%. And then the next column shows that the revenue is at under baseline is at $2,672,000 of compensatory revenue. That would go up to $2,714,000 under Representative Feist's bill. So there's an increase in revenue for the Bemidji School District. Mr. Chair, if Ms. Burke could go down to the Brainerd School District. Oh my goodness, Ms. Burke is so competent. The Brainerd School District, District 181, has a relatively similar level of students, 6,420, a relatively similar percentage of the students are at free or reduced price lunch. And you can see there's no change there. And that's because the concentration at the Brainerd sites is not as variable as the concentration at poverty at the Bemidji sites. And this would be evident if we switch to the other spreadsheet that shows by site. We'll go to the Bemidji site and you'll see that there's a these are all the sites that are above 80% free and reduced price meal eligibility. And on this site.
And Mr. We'll... Strom?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kreshaw, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Strom, in the interest of time, that's what I was looking at was the per district one. You don't necessarily have to bring up the first site one. I can save you a little bit of time. But my question is, being very familiar with both Bemidji and Brainerd, does this create a situation where if I move some kids around between the elementaries, I could hit those threshold and therefore I could try to get to that 80% cap? Is that the scenario that could possibly be created since it's size based?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Grisha, yes, it's site based. If a district had a plan in place that concentrated poverty at a site, that may yield that result. I'd have to look at the individual details for each of the schools in the two comparison districts to see if that would matter. I'm not sure in the Brainerd district if any of the sites are above 80% or how close they are to that,
sure.
And whether the district could rearrange to get that result or not. Others may want to speak to the way that school boards and school districts make attendance decisions for school sites, but that certainly the site variability has been a part of the issue as this committee over the years has addressed compensatory revenue, whether that should be addressed at the site level or the district level.
Okay. Mr. Strom?
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you. And I'll keep moving along here. Mr. Strom, with the changes in the, or to the bill testifier, whoever, but I'll direct it to you first, Mr. Strom. With the changes in just getting the compensatory paperwork done or the free and reduced paperwork done once every 4 years, would that, if kids move amongst the sites or if they leave, let's say we have another, you know, crazy event like we had with COVID where we have declining enrollment, how does that affect this compensatory calculation? In other words, let's say, and I just want to make sure I understand this, let's say a school district is at 82% for a site, but suddenly we go into a COVID situation and many of those kids choose to go to other schools, private homeschool, whatever. Does that percentage still stay there or is it readjusted based on unique situations like we would have with COVID?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, members, there are under the amendment adopted that Representative Feist offered, there are three alternatives. One of those is if you're a CEP site that you automatically use the same count for the 4 years duration of the CEP. So if you fit that definition, a student leaving the site or not for a pandemic or other reason wouldn't come into play. In the second scenario, if a student left the site under the language in the amendment right now, it counts as long as the student's at the same site. So if the student left the site to go to another school, graduated from fifth to sixth grade, or or left because of a pandemic or something, then that student would no longer be enrolled at that site and would not count automatically at that site. The third case would be the current counting method, which would be the count at each site each fall. And one point to make about all of this that may get us a little off track, I hope not, is that count is always from the previous fiscal year. So for example, for the governor's hold harmless that's being proposed, that's for fiscal year 22, but based on the count from the fall of 2020 compared to the count from fall of 2019.
Thank you, Representative Krisha, I think Representative Feist would also like to respond to your line of questioning if she could at this time. Thank you, Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that, you know, the goal with these amendments is to create a more consistent, stable funding measure for compensatory revenue. And that's in line with the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, which recommended that we monitor the use of reporting codes and improve the count, the way that we're counting students. And so the goal here is to just create a more stable measure of eligibility for compensatory funding. And ultimately, I think we need to take it the next step and create a more holistic way of measuring need within the various schools.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Representative Krisha, additional questions?
I do have two more. I think I'll make my time here. I'll be very quick. So two questions. Representative Feist, to the bill author. So you just mentioned you're trying to fix the OLA recommendations, all that, respect that. With respect to that, what would you anticipate would be the achievement outcomes that would be increased by doing this for these schools?
Representative Feist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that really goes to the desire to ensure that these funds are spent on evidence-based practices. So the language already for compensatory revenue enumerates the specific types of activities that we can spend these dollars on, all of which are aimed at addressing the opportunity gap. But requiring that those practices be spent on evidence-based methods, I think we'll get to the next large finding of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, which talked about how we need to better measure the impact of these dollars. And I think that Professor Gibbons' presentation to this committee was really enlightening. And she had one slide that I pulled up where she's like, we need to test hypotheses. We need to do data analysis. We need to develop surveys. And then we ultimately need to figure out, like, is this working? How fast is it working? How well is it working? And so I'm particularly excited about that element of this bill. And I do believe that we will have a much better sense of what these dollars are doing for our kids.
Very good.
Representative Krisha?
Last quick question to AMSD. Mr. Cronquist, you said that you support this, which is great. So you support this, all of your school districts support this, and the mandates that'll go along with this, as Representative Feist said, tying this to evidence-based programs, and therefore, do you also agree this will increase outcomes for your schools?
Mr. Cronquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Krisha. Yes, as I noted, we are getting additional feedback from our districts just on the 80% requirement at the site. Really want to just make sure that that's not going to create issues for anybody in serving the students that really do need those additional supports and services. But yes, otherwise, Representative Krisha, we do strongly support the bill and look forward to continuing to work with the author and the committee moving forward.
Representative Krisha, any further questions?
I have to respect my time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Feist, any brief closing remarks before we recess?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a final few points. So the first, which we've just been talking about, is that this bill really addresses the recommendations of the OLA. We're going to make sure that we are improving our understanding of the impact of these funds and that we're going to really address how we are identifying which students need these funds better. Second, I am really excited about the impact of the amendment on allowing schools to really take full advantage of the CEP federal funding. We need to make the best use we can of those federal dollars that schools are eligible for, And I believe that this amendment and this bill is going to help us do that. And lastly, this bill is about investing in kids. And I tried to find updated stats. The most recent one I could find says that if we address the opportunity gap in this country, that the GDP would be $670 billion higher. So we know that this is about investing in our future, our economic future. And I am just really excited about the ways that we can address compensatory revenue to make sure that all kids all across the state of Minnesota can thrive and achieve their full potential. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. With that, Representative Feist renews her motion to lay over House File 1144 as amended for possible inclusion. Members, thank you for this morning's hearing. We will be reconvening at 6 p.m. And given that, we are now in recess. Thank you. Welcome back, members, to this 6 p.m. Reconvening of the House Education Finance Committee. We will begin in 10 seconds. Give the good people at House Info a minute or 10 seconds. Good evening. Remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they're attached in the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Because this hearing is resumed from earlier this morning, members will be marked by their attendance from this morning's meeting. This evening, the committee will be hearing another handful of bills, and we don't have time to waste, so we will get right to it. The order of the bills is reflected on the agenda updated for members this afternoon. We're taking up House File 1530 first, followed by House File 1710, then House File 1997. At that point, we'll pause and hear from MDE on the governor's updated budget recommendations, and then we'll conclude with House File 1081, which we heard informationally in committee last week, but now formally have it in our possession. We'll be laying all these bills over for possible inclusion tonight. On to House File 1530 of Representative Fu Leeds. Representative Sandstead, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1530 before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1530 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Sandstead. Representative Lee, welcome to the committee. Members, we are looking to lay this bill over by 6:15 or so. Representative Lee?
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Sandstead, for moving the bill. This is a proposal to add another method for increasing state adult basic education aid by linking ABE funding increases to the K-12 basic revenue funding increases. If the formula allowance per pupil funding for K-12 increases by 2% in a year, then ABE state funding could increase by 2%. This proposal will keep the 10-year average contact hour growth as an alternate method for potentially increasing state ABE funding. This proposal will apply whichever method resulted in the greatest percentage growth in funding while still capping funding growth by no more than 3% annually. And Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers to talk about this need. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I have a list of three testifiers. First on the list is Karen Walters, ABE program coordinator for the Mankato Area Schools. Ms. Walters, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Representative Davney and members of the committee. My name is Karen Walters, and I coordinate Mankato Area Adult Basic Education, a consortium comprised of six school districts in South Central Minnesota. The proposal we're bringing to your attention today will help us keep up with the demand for ABE services as we move out of the pandemic and into our new normal. It is an exciting and challenging time for education, and ABE is no exception. Due to slowed immigration and very low unemployment, student contact hours have declined statewide for several years prior to the pandemic. And since the pandemic in Mankato, we've experienced an overall 25% decline in enrollment and 50% drop in contact hours. What's difficult about a slow decline is that we can't shrink our expenses. For example, a class size of 25 a few years ago that has now dropped to 16 students still requires the teacher, space, intake, testing, and support services. In addition, ABE now offers job training and adult career pathway programming, which has smaller cohorts and is expensive to offer. When this slight decline in hours happens over years, it results in decreased funding at the same time we are experiencing an increase in salaries and overhead. Small tweaks to the ABE funding formula, such as increases that mirror the K-12 system, would keep ABE moving in the right direction. In visiting with colleagues, I do anticipate increased ABE enrollments this fall. The districts and workforce agencies would like GED offered year-round, which means extending summer programming for students who do not finish high school due to the pandemic. Some of our adult learners report that they are waiting to resume their education until we are in person or their children return to school. And at the same time, some adults are thriving in the online environment as barriers such as transportation in rural areas have been alleviated. It will be a great challenge for ABE providers to meet the expectation to offer both remote and in-person learning in the future with our current funding. Please support the proposed changes to the ABE funding so that we can provide the options our learners need in order to improve their English, attain their high school diplomas, enter training, and upskill into better paying jobs. Our future economy depends on everyone working and advancing to higher levels of literacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walters. Next on my agenda is Kaya Bergen, representing IMABE. Ms. Bergen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kaya Bergen. Thank you for having me. And as noted, my support for this proposal comes from my role as an adult basic education and an instructor, as well as a member of the adult education advocacy group, IMABE. So as you may know, in ABE, we work with adults at all stages of life, from the new American who is going to school for the first time and learning their ABCs, to the person who's been born in Minnesota and needs to get their GED or complete a job training that lets them get hired or get a promotion. And so, as Karen noted, without adjustments in funding over the years, what we're essentially doing is trying to provide the same services, but without an increase in the funding to do it. And as we transition out of this year, I think that the needs of adult learners are only going to continue to grow as people who lost their jobs seek to re-enter the job market. And also, I think we've digitized to such a degree over the past year that'll impact people's needs as well. So an increase in our funding would help us better meet the needs of those students. And it would also mean that ABE could be a more sustainable job. So that would allow us to diversify our instructions and hopefully attract more teachers of color to the field. Thank you so much for listening to me.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen. Pardon me. Last on my list of testifiers is Renata Rudmanas, ABE supervisor with St. Paul Public Schools.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, and good evening, everyone. My name is Renata Ritmanis, and I'm the Adult Basic Education Supervisor for St. Paul Public Schools. I testified before this committee 2 years ago about the importance of stable ABE funding to make sure that our programming was able to keep up with growing demands. Little did I know how much we would be asked to grow. In the past year, we've taken our entire program online and now virtually serve over 750 students a week in our ELL, GED, math, college and job training programs. Our students come to us with a variety of college, career, and community goals. They also come with a long list of barriers. This was true before COVID and is even truer now when technology skills and access stand between many of our students and their success. In many cases, the gap between the skills our students currently have and what they will need for college or a job are wider than ever. As many of us have learned this year, even just helping kids with homework requires a new set of skills. The resource gap has also grown. Some of our students attend online class and complete assignments using only their smartphones. Others share a device with their children. And we've lost some students entirely during this time because they have no way of attending online class. But we've learned a lot during this past year, and the future of ABE looks promising, but challenging. Starting next month in St. Paul, we plan to offer instruction in person, online, using a HyFlex model, and through distance learning coaching. Flexibility has always been ABE's middle name, and if we have the right resources, we can be even more equitable, inclusive, and effective through these increased options. But they require technology, outreach, professional development, and high-quality staffing to become and remain a reality. Stable ABE funding would allow us to more confidently plan for a future where we are reaching every ABE student with the tools and instruction that they need. Thank you so much for your time and for considering this proposal.
Thank you, Ms. Rudmanis. Members, questions? Seeing none, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of the hearing. We received no request from the public to testify. Representative Lee, do you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the consideration.
Thank you very much, Representative Lee. With that, Representative Sandsteed renews her motion to lay House File 1530 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Lee. Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. We'll now move along to House File 1710. Representative Wolgamott, would you like to make a motion to move your bill, House File 1710, to be before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair. So moved.
All right. Very good. Members of the committee, we're looking to lay this bill over by 6:30. Representative Wolgamott, before you introduce your bill, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A1 author's amendment to be before the committee to put the bill in the shape you desire?
So moved, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Members, any discussion to the Wolgamott motion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none. Members, all on the Wolgamott motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Wolgamott, to your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here this evening to present House File 1710. I'm presenting this bill because Minnesota has a long history of supporting regional library systems, which aim to improve library services for the benefit of citizens in all corners of our state. I know myself personally, we've got the Great River Regional Library in St. Cloud, and it's just a wonderful spot to bring my kids to learn, to meet other people in our community. I've had a bunch of town halls at our library. There are just so many benefits to having good, strong libraries all throughout our state. So that's why I'm here to present House File 1710 to increase state funding to the 12 regional public library systems by $2 million each year. The 12 systems currently receive $13.57 million a year, and the 2007 legislature was the last time we increased support for regional library systems. The bill also amends the distribution formula for the 12 regional library systems, a move that is supported by all 12 regional library boards. This formula change will stabilize funding to each region by reducing the volatile equalization factor and increasing the basic aid portion of the formula. As you know, Mr. Chair and members, libraries are a cornerstone of our educational system as they serve lifelong learners. Advances in internet capacity are not making libraries irrelevant. In fact, it's the opposite. Demand for library services is steady and increasing. Citizens of all ages rely on public libraries for lifelong learning and digital literacy. That's why I'm presenting this bill. That's why I'm asking for your support And with me today are two testifiers who can tell you more about the impact of this legislation. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn over to them to provide their testimony at this time.
Thank you, Representative Wolgemont. I do have two testifiers on my list. First is Karen Punsack, Executive Director of the Great River Regional Library. Ms. Punsack, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and Education Finance Committee members for the time to talk about the impact of regional library basic system support tonight. And thank you, Representative Wolgemont, for authoring House File 1710 and your enthusiastic support of public libraries. My name is Karen Punsack. I'm the Director of Great River Regional Library, one of Minnesota's 12 regional public library systems. We operate 32 libraries in central Minnesota, in cities as large as St. Cloud and as small as Gray Eagle. House File 1710 asks for a $2 million increase in state library aid and a change to the distribution formula. Public libraries helped students and families weather the storm of COVID-19. This formula change would help public libraries weather the future by stabilizing our main source of state funding. This formula is more unstable than other education formulas. Its factors include a base amount, land area, population, and equalization, which includes adjusted net tax capacity. The amounts received range from $5.2 million for metro area MELSA and $328,000 for Northwest Regional Library in Thief River Falls. It is not unusual for a library's distribution amount to vary by 30% or more year over year. Some systems have seen steady declines in funding for more than 5 years. The 12 regions, as Representative Wolgemont said, we're all in support of this. We represent 87 counties, and our governing boards agree this formula is flawed. We need an increase in funding to adjust the formula without taking dollars away from any region. This crucial change will provide regional public libraries a better base of support to serve students and families. Because the formula has fluctuated so much over the past decade, some systems are struggling with reduced funding. Plum Creek Library System, headquartered in Worthington, recently had to make a hard choice: hire a permanent director or replace their delivery van with 500,000 miles. This delivery van is part of our interlibrary loan system, so it has a ripple effect on every Minnesotan using a public library. Plum Creek received $337,000 last year and has seen a reduction in state aid every year since 2013, even with no change to the state allocation. This is just one example of how the formula's instability negatively impacts the services Minnesotans receive. Public libraries provide vital access to technology and broadband. They support students, their families, and lifelong learners. Public libraries demonstrated this throughout this past year. In Piers last spring, when the school was going to distance learning and the library was closing, the librarian reached out to her borrowers to make sure they had internet hotspots for distance learning. The families were so relieved that internet access was not going to be an issue. And one family even had neighboring students connecting through their hotspot too. Great River also partnered with Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota to distribute hotspots for their work with families and children. They are located on the southeast side of St. Cloud and offer year-round academic programs for youth and resources for adults. Libraries are a place where all people are welcome and invited. In August, the Great River Board reaffirmed this as part of our core values. We are inclusive and embrace diversity. We are dedicated to finding ways to provide every opportunity to the students and families in our communities. Public libraries provide connection to reliable broadband, access to ebooks, and access to physical books for everyone. These are just a few examples of how public libraries in central Minnesota stepped up during the pandemic. Stories like this happened in 365 communities with a public library across the state. Thank you, Education Finance Committee, for the time to present this bill after bringing it to Conference Committee 2 years ago. We hope this is the year to get this done. Please support a formula change to ensure a stable source of state library funding for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Punsack. Next on my list is Dr. Zuria Anjum, Stearns County Citizen Representative of the Great River Regional Library Board of Trustees. Dr. Anjum, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening. Thank you, Chair Dabney and Education and Finance Committee members for allowing me the time to talk about the impact of the Regional Library Basic Support System. Thank you, Representative Volgamott, for authoring HF 1710 in support of public libraries. My name is Zuria Anjum. I'm a first-generation immigrant from Pakistan, a psychiatrist by profession, and a mother to two teenage kids. I've served on the Great River Regional Library Board since 2016 and have worked with the board on various issues, including diversity and equity. The library recently completed a community survey related to this, and the recommendations will be added to our next strategic plan. Libraries serve as a gateway to knowledge and culture all over the world. Morocco has the world's oldest currently operating library, which was founded back in the 9th century. Since then, civilized nations invest in libraries as social infrastructure for education and uplift of society. Some people argue that in the 21st century, the need for libraries is diminished as there is digital content available for most consumers. This, however, does not take into account numerous issues that face a community, including language barriers, financial concerns, lack of knowledge in accessing resources and utilizing them, just to name a few. A library provides all these essential services to all its community members. According to a Pew Research Center survey done in 2015, 65% of all Americans aged 16 and over used a public library in the past year and said that closing their local branch would have a, quote, major impact on their community, unquote. This sentiment is even higher in marginalized communities, with 78% of Hispanics, 72% of women, 70% of parents with minor children, and 70% of those aged 50 or older stating that closing their library would have a major impact on their community. In the current age, libraries are not just places you visit to get a book. They provide essential resources to learning a new language, expanding vocabulary and knowledge, finding information, and improving computer and technical skills. The impact of disruption to these services was felt by the community clearly in this last year, as the pandemic severely limited the ability of the library's services. Great River Regional Library, recognizing the need, spent a significant amount of time and resources coming up with solutions to these barriers. From providing curbside pickups to expanding digital access to books, movies, and music, print-to-go services, adding hotspots for people to access the internet, modifying reading programs, and adding a hotline to provide information to the community about the library technology hours and issues. These efforts were commendable, but more can be done, but requires a commitment from you to help them continue this effort. Libraries also serve as a crucial, critical role in the community. They have always been a safe and welcome place for all to meet to pursue their interests, whether that be a book club, kids' story time and reading programs, literacy programs, or research groups. In conclusion, it is for these reasons that I'm asking for your support of HF 1710. This investment in public libraries will repay us with generations of reward and lift all of our communities. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Anjum. Ninth century, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Members, questions? Seeing none, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this bill hearing. We received no requests from the public to testify. Representative Wolgamott, do you have any brief closing remarks?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for taking the time to hear this bill. And I really want to thank my two testifiers today for all the work that they do to make sure that that my kids and kids throughout our community and everyone in Central Minnesota can come to the library to learn, to recreate, to grow. Libraries really are special. And Mr. Chair, members, with all my heart, I'm asking you to support House File 1710. Let's get this in our omnibus bill so that we can fund libraries and fund opportunities for Minnesotans through every corner of our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Thank you, Ms. Punsack and Dr. Anjum. With that, Representative Wolgamott renews his motion to lay over House File 1710 as amended for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Next on our list, members, is House File 1997. I just don't know. I've been able to say it any number of
times. It's the evening, that's all.
It is. Representative Igbaje, my apologies. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Feist, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1997 before the committee for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. I so move.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Members of the committee and members of the public, we're looking to lay this bill over by 6:45. Representative Igbaje, welcome to the committee, so you may proceed by briefly introducing your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. This evening, I am presenting House File 1997, which is an appropriation for the Girls in Action program. So the history of this program is one of success. The program was developed by Dr. Verna Price more than 15 years ago, after she was approached by North High School to help them re-engage their female students who have been getting into fights and other troubling situations. So since then, the program has gone on to empower young women, help them succeed in the classroom, re-engage them in learning, and encourage future career opportunities. The program has since expanded from North High School to schools across the metro area and community-based programs throughout Minnesota. And the program also supports girls in different parts of the world. In order for the program to continue to thrive, we are asking for an additional investment of $1.5 million to ensure that more young women have access to this program. This investment would support community-based programs focused on the needs of Asian, East African, and Latina girls. In addition to providing educational support, the program offers guidance to the families of participants to ensure that the families are also engaged in the program. The program also showcases successful alumni and other women leaders to provide living examples of what is possible for these young women once they graduate from school. The program also has a high rate of attendance, improvement in grades, improvement in graduation rates, and high college acceptance, which is detailed in the handout that was provided. So with me today is an alumna from the program who can speak more to the impact of it and the impact it had in her life. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Igbaje. I understand your original testifier was unable to make it, so Ms. Burnsides is here to fill in, pinch hitting tonight. Thank you for that. Ms. Burnside, please state your name for the record and proceed with your brief testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Asia Burnside for the record, and I am a graduating senior at the illustrious Virginia State University, and I graduated from the Girls in Action program in 2017 after being a part of the program for 3 years. Girls in Action is a program that definitely changes girls' lives, and that is a complete understatement. I was raised by a single mother. I graduated from Washington Technology in St. Paul, and my mother was amazing, but being a single mother, she couldn't do it all. But having Girls in Action and mentors such as Miss Christina, Miss Kiara, and Dr. Verna, they support you and they push you to be your best self. They gave us exposures to different things by doing our like annual tea party, just letting us be able to dress up and really just be the women we are. They really teach you how to cultivate yourself into that woman that you really are, like building confidence. One thing that we learned in Girls in Action was VIPL, valuable, important, powerful, and lovable. And those are four things that we always said at the end of each of our meetings. These women really support us in anything we want to do. Even when I was on my way to college, when I first began in my freshman year, Girls in Action provided me a scholarship that was much needed that covered that little bit of balance that I had left to cover my freshman year. These mentors aren't just with you while you're in the program, but they follow you outside of the program. Even still today, I speak to one of my mentors, and she really just guides me through things that I'm struggling with as a woman or things that I just need help with as a person. That's what this program does for you. You're a part of it for life. No matter what, you are a part of Girls in Action for life, and it's really just a support system that myself and my peers really needed, especially my other peers that didn't have like mothers to support them, such as mine. Like Girls in Action, those mentors, they become a part of your village and really change your life. And so if anything that I could say is please support the Girls in Action program, it changes lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And there was some excitement about your college choice. Amongst the people on the Zoom. Members, any questions regarding House File 1997. Seeing none.
I just have my hand up.
Oh, well, sorry, Representative Thompson. I didn't see that. My apologies. Please.
I have a question, but to the last testifier, I don't know if she knows I try not to tell everybody that, but my daughter's a part of this program. And there's things that my daughter can't tell me, or I'm assuming 15-year-old little girls don't like to tell their dad everything. But they do talk to the women involved in this. And so just to have a place to vent, and I'm cool with that. Like, I really appreciate what you bring to the table. And I just want to say thank you personally. I never got a chance to meet you guys, but I just want to say thank you personally for what you've done for my daughter.
A little dad testimonial. Representative Feist, I see your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say how great I think this program is. One of the first times, maybe the first time I ever went to the Capitol in St. Paul was bringing a bunch of girls from Girls in Action to the Capitol to meet with their representatives. It's just such a great program, and I'm just very supportive. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, members, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this bill hearing. We received no requests from the public to testify. Representative Igbaje, do you have any closing remarks?
Sure. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing this bill. As you heard, it changes lives. So I strongly hope that the committee will consider including this in its final bill. So thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative Feist renews her motion to lay House File 1997 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Ms. Burnside, Representative Igbaje, thank you both very much for joining us tonight. Members, we're going to pause from hearing bills at this point for a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Education on Governor Walz's supplemental budget recommendations. Mr. Uni is with us and will be leading the presentation. Mr. Uni?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations here at the Department of Education. And really, thank you to the chair and the committee for giving the department the opportunity to present the governor's supplemental budget for this session. And just to start out, so the governor last week on the 18th released his revised biennial budget, which adds approximately $87 million for K-12 education, bringing the new total education investment to about $745 million. And I'm just going to detail some of the provisions that are either new or were revised. And with me, I have our Director of Finance, Terry Yetter, who will be able to answer any follow-up questions you have that maybe pertain to some of the formula-driven proposals. The first and largest part of the revised or the supplemental budget is a compensatory aid hold harmless. Essentially, this guarantees at least the same average compensatory revenue per student in fiscal year 22 as districts received in fiscal 21. And this mitigates the revenue loss resulting from the underreporting of students eligible for free and reduced price lunch meals in the 2021 school year. This is even with the extension for this reporting that the legislature, and we thank you all, passed in the 7th special session to allow some more time for districts to go out and get these free and reduced price lunch applications extended about 2 or 3 weeks. Even with that, the counts were still overwhelmed by undercounting because of several reasons. And those are undercounting occurred because the federal program allowed meals to be free. The exchange of paper can become more difficult during distance learning, and the undercounting of students experiencing homelessness due to the lack of daily transportation to school where they would normally be identified. This is about $68 million in one-time funding, and it will be paid out on a 90-10 basis. So 90% of it will be paid out in fiscal 22, and 10% will be paid out in fiscal 23. The next provision is a little bit smaller. It's tribal contract aid hold harmless provision, and it adds a one-time declining enrollment to tribal contract aid, which is based on 20.5% of the general education formula allowance. And this would be part of the pandemic enrollment loss proposal, and it's a little bit over $50,000 one-time increase. The next proposal is in the student support personnel for and it'll be an increase for cooperatives and intermediates. It'll be coming in at around $1.7 million for fiscal 22 and 23, and then it'll be $950,000 per year in ongoing funding. And how this works is it'll increase the per student amount for intermediates and for co-ops from the current four, or from the prior four, to $6 per student that is in their member districts. And this funding serves the state's highest need students that are served in co-ops and intermediates. There'll be some additional funding to two existing programs that were already in the governor's budget. One is additional funding for non-exclusionary discipline training, which dovetails with the policy, non-exclusionary discipline policy that was in the governor's policy bill, and that is also in HF 1081, which will be heard later. This is an increase of $7.5 million in fiscal 22 and 23. That's over the, that's gonna be $5 million per year ongoing. The prior allocation was $1.25 million per year. And just as a reminder, this is gonna be for grants of up to $50,000 per district or charter to create and implement model policies and behavior for discipline. This will now allow for grants of up to 90 districts and charters, and it'll help fund a team at the Department of Education to provide best practices support around non-exclusionary discipline practices. The other item that there will be additional funding for is for out-of-school tutoring opportunities. If you remember, just recently, again, thank you to the chair, to Chair Dabney for carrying HF 1064, which is the summer learning package. That includes a proposal of $3.25 million for out-of-school tutoring opportunities. That's $3.25 million. And this proposal would now create ongoing funding for that program of $5 million per year. So that's $10 million over the biennium. And the final addition to the package is a no-cost addition, and that's some revisions to the Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate STEM grant program, which is about $250,000. And that would allow for some tweaks with a focus on AP computer science courses, as well as changing the funding model so that districts could receive up to $75,000 per year. And the changes really increase the participation and access for districts to create these types of programs. And with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes the overview of the governor's supplemental budget.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Members, any questions regarding the governor's supplemental budget proposal? Mr. Rooney, it's a quiet bunch tonight. Thank you very much for that overview. We do appreciate it. Members, we'll now take up House File 1081, and we're looking to lay this bill over by 7:25 p.m. Well before that. You'll remember that we gave this bill an informational hearing last Wednesday, March 17th. We didn't have the bill in our possession at that time because the bill needed to make a stop in the Judiciary Committee. However, we wanted to devote an entire hearing to it nonetheless. The bill was the only bill on our agenda that night, which provided us robust opportunity to discuss what was in the bill. For those of you following the Education Policy Committee, or jointly serving on this committee and education policy, you'll remember that public testimony was taken on the bill the week prior to our hearing on Wednesday, March 10th in education policy. As is customary with a policy omnibus that is sent to a parent finance committee, we would be looking to take public testimony on any of the provisions from House File 1081 just after our walkthrough on our final bill. In order for us to get to that final step, however, tonight we need to bring up the bill since it's now in our possession and lay it over for possible inclusion. Members, any questions regarding the process? Seeing none, excellent. Chair Richardson, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1081 before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I moved House File 1081 before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Chair Richardson, do you have any further comments on your bill that you'd like to share?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to make a note to members and the public that there were two amendments that were adopted in the Judiciary Committee on March 18th. So therefore, the bill that is before you is the second engrossment. Just really quickly, the first amendment clarified that under the unrequested leave of absence process, any data that committee would deal with about individual teachers would be private personnel data. Other committee data would be public by default unless it was protected under another law. And that amendment really mirrored the treatment of individual teacher data and other areas of K through 12 related statutes. And then there was a second amendment that was a technical fix to address an error in drafting. In education policy, there was an amendment that was divided regarding the physical education requirement, and only one line of that divided amendment was adopted. However, in the engrossment, there was an error and the entire amendment was included. So the amendment just brought the bill back in line with the committee's intent. And Mr. Chair, if you would like, Ms. Parra can point out the page and line references in the bill if that's helpful for members or the public.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Ms. Parra, do you want to provide the page and line references for members?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And those changes are on page, the credit changes are page 11, lines 12 to 14. And the data practices changes are on page 84, lines 18 to 19. That's that subdivision four.
Thank you, Ms. Parra. Members, any further questions? Seeing none, as I've said moments ago, it's a quiet bunch tonight, Chair Richardson. Any further, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I would just add that there are a few provisions that are still under discussion with groups that are working on improvements. And just thank you for the opportunity to get this move for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much. And with that, Chair Richardson renews her motion to lay House File 1081 over for possible for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. With that, members, thank you for your time this evening. Staff, as always, thank you very much for your time. We are adjourned.